So good morning, everyone, and welcome to Zhangyang Bath, and welcome to this one-day event titled Vipassana, Insight into Reality. Just a couple of logistics before we start. So the schedule today is that we'll be going from 10 till 4, four sessions, four one-hour sessions. So we'll do 10 till 11, and then we'll have a tea break, 11 to 11.30, second session will be 11.30 to 12.30. Then we have lunch break for an hour till 1.30. Third session is 1.30 to 2.30. Again, afternoon tea break, 2.30 till 3. Last session, 3 till 4. So four sessions today. With the sessions today, I like to be very interactive. So it's not like I give a long presentation and then ask for questions at the end. So while I'm explaining certain things, if you have some doubts or questions, then please raise your hand and we'll do the questions as we go. So I like to be very interactive in my sessions. Hopefully you've all got these handouts. There's two charts here, the suffering and its causes and three vehicles charts. We'll be actually looking at those in the very first session this morning, so keep them handy. And then the other logistic, of course, is make sure you've switched off your mobile phones, because particularly later we'll be doing some meditation sessions, so if your phone goes off during that, it might be a bit distracting. Okay, so let's begin then. And we'll begin by looking at what is this word vipassana? What does it mean? So vipassana is the Sanskrit term. Probably most of you are more familiar with the Pali term of vipassana. So vipassana is the Sanskrit word and vipassana is the Pali word. So in both of those words, the VI part of the word means higher or superior. And passana or pasana means to see. So vipassana or vipassana is higher seeing, seeing beyond. And often this word or these words are translated into English as either special insight or simply insight. So we're talking about insight practice. And so when we talk about insight, of course, we're talking about gaining insight into the nature of reality. Why is it important? Why is vipassana or vipassana practice important? Why is it important to gain insight into the nature of reality? Well, the Buddhist assertion, of course, is that it's our distorted view of reality that actually is the root of all of our mental afflictions and suffering. So from a Buddhist perspective, if we really want to overcome our mental afflictions and suffering, we need to go back to the source, to the root, and that root is a mistaken view of reality. So therefore, if we really want to overcome mental afflictions and suffering, we need to overcome this fundamental ignorance, our mistaken view of reality. So what we're going to be doing today is, first, we're going to look at how we distort reality, what are our distorted views of reality. Then we're going to look at how that is actually the cause of our mental afflictions and suffering. Then we're going to look at how we go about establishing a correct view of reality. And then on that basis, we're going to look at then how do we meditate or cultivate that correct view of reality to come to realize the nature of reality so that we can overcome our mental afflictions and suffering. And as part of that, how can we integrate this vipassana practice into our daily life? So that's sort of the topics we're going to be covering today. So we'll start by looking at the first point is in terms of how we distort reality, how we have a mistaken view of reality. And we distort reality in a number of different ways, and we're going to briefly outline four ways in which we have a distorted false view of reality. The first way in which we distort reality is that we tend to see things as being stable and unchanging. Of course, intellectually, we understand that's not true because science has proven it. We learnt it at school. We learnt this idea that everything's changing in every single moment. And I think we all accept that intellectually. So we don't have any problem there. But is that how we relate to things in our experience? Or do we relate to, for example, this glass here as being, well, this is more or less the same glass that was here yesterday. It'll be the same glass here tomorrow. I think this is how we relate to things in our experience. We tend to see them as quite stable and unchanging. And that's why we end up with problems, because in our experience, we're out of sync with reality, because the reality is that this is changing in every single moment. But how we relate to it in our experience is not like that. We relate to it as being fairly stable and unchanging. Things are, you know, this will be the same glass here tomorrow. So that's one way which we distort reality. Another way in which we distort reality is that we often see our experiences in the nature of happiness, because we all want to be happy. And so what we tend to do is that we see our pleasant experiences in the nature of happiness. And then we grasp onto those experiences, hoping that they're going to satisfy us and fulfill us. But as we're going to see, if we look closely at those pleasant experiences, are they really in the nature of happiness? Because actually, if those pleasant experiences were in the nature of happiness, it would mean the more pleasant experience we have, the more happy we should become. And we know intellectually that's not the case. We know that if we overindulge, for example, in pleasant tasting food, we don't become more happy. We get indigestion and we get sick. Or if we enjoy sitting in the sun, nice warm sun, the longer we sit in the sun, we don't get more happy. We get dehydrated, sunburnt, and suffer. So intellectually, we maybe appreciate that these pleasant experiences are not really in the nature of happiness, but that's not our experience. We grasp onto those pleasant experiences as if they were in the nature of happiness, and that's a problem. Another way in which we distort reality is how we view ourselves as a person. We really experientially feel that there's an autonomous self here. There's this autonomous me, this self-sufficient me, this me that seems to exist within itself, separate from everything else. So this is how we experientially see ourselves. But again, as we're going to see, if we actually investigate, we'll come to see, well, actually, there's no autonomous self here, because the self, the me that exists, of course, is depending on the body and the mind. So intellectually, we can come to appreciate that fact, but experientially, that's not how we relate to ourselves as a person. We really believe that somewhere here, there is this me, this autonomous me that is sort of stands apart from everything else. And instinctively, that's how we see ourselves. And again, so we're out of sync with reality, and that creates problems. And then there's a fourth way in which we distort reality, and that's the one we're really going to be focusing on mainly today. Is that we believe that there is an independent me here and an independent objective world out there. In other words, we tend to believe in this subject-object duality, that there is some sort of objective world out there independent of us. And so from a Buddhist perspective, we have all of these distortions, and each one of them brings a whole lot of problems to us. But from the Buddhist perspective, the deepest level of distortion is this one. And so that if we can really overcome this distortion, this ignorance, these will be overcome. Whereas if we simply overcome the earlier ones, it may be not the case that we're still holding on to this distortion. So this is the most subtle level of distortion that we engage in. So we're going to look at all of those four distortions and how to overcome them, but this is the one that we're going to be mainly focusing on today. Any questions on that before we move on? Anything not clear there? Yeah.
I'm a bit confused between the difference between 3 and 4.
Yeah. To answer that, it'll become apparent in my discussions.
Okay.
There is a difference, but yes, it can be a little bit subtle, but hopefully in my explanations of these points, it will become more obvious what is the difference.
Okay. Okay.
So if it doesn't get answered later, yeah. Ask that again.
Okay.
Later.
Yeah.
Anything else? Okay. So this is how we distort reality. Again, intellectually, maybe we understand some of these things are false. Maybe we understand all of this is false intellectually. But unfortunately, our behaviour is not driven by our intellectual understanding. Our behaviour is driven by our instinctive habit. And our instinctive habit generally tells us that things are quite stable, that actually our pleasant experiences are in the nature of happiness, that there is this autonomous me here, and that actually there is some independent objective world there. That's how we relate to things instinctively. And that, from a Buddhist perspective, is we're out of sync with reality, and that will bring mental afflictions and suffering. So let's have a look at how this distortion leads to mental afflictions and suffering. What is the process? And so for that, we'll need to look at this suffering and its causes chart. And in particular, again, I'm going to focus on this one, the fourth level of distortion, the most subtle level. How is it that by seeing that there's an independent me and an independent objective world, how does that lead to things like attachment, aversion, anger, jealousy, and how does that lead then to suffering? So that's what we're going to look at now using that chart. So we can see in the chart that there are basically 6 stages in the process. At the first stage of the process, there's what's called seed of ignorance. And so ignorance here, I mean, ignorance in general is being confused about something. Here, of course, we're talking about being confused about the nature of reality. And in particular here, we're talking about the particular confusion that of believing there's a me here and an objective world there. So that's what we're talking about here, is this ignorance that grasps onto the, yes, there is an independent me here and an independent objective world there. The word seed here really just means habit. So we have the habit of that grasping. We have the habit of believing there's a me here and an objective world there. And from a Buddhist perspective, we've had that habit since we were born and well before that. It's not something that we newly developed in this life, that it's been with us always. So we have this habit. And then, of course, when we look out on the world, everything that we see appears to exist independent of us. So things appear, there appears to be this subject-object duality. So there appears to be what's called dualistic, there's dualistic appearance. There seems to be subject-object duality. But in Buddhism, this is false. The way in which things appear to us is not how they exist. So this is what's called mistaken dualistic appearance. And of course, everything appears to us in this way. We've never experienced things in any other way. And so because that is how everything appears to us, everything appears to exist independent of us, and we have the habit of believing that, then there's no reason to question appearances. We just accept automatically. So we automatically accept, yep, things are independent of us. And that's step 2, is ignorance. So ignorance is simply accepting, yes, there is an independent me and an independent world there. There's no reason for us to question these appearances because we don't have any other experience. In every one of our experiences, there is one mental factor that's always present, and that is the mental factor of feeling. Now, here in Buddhism, the word feeling doesn't mean emotion. So normally when we use the word feeling, you know, how are you feeling today, we're talking about our emotional state. The word feeling in Buddhism does not mean emotion. The mental factor of feeling is simply experiencing things as either pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. Neutral just means neither pleasant nor unpleasant. So every one of our experiences, we experience things as either pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. So, when we experience things as pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral, together with the belief that they're independent of us, that will lead to the third step. Because, for example, let's say we're looking at these flowers over here. And let's say we're having a pleasant experience when we view these flowers. Then that pleasant experience, together with the belief that those flowers are existing independent of us, will, of course, naturally lead us to believe that there must be some beauty there that's causing my pleasant experience. So we're going to see those flowers as inherently attractive. And from the Buddhist perspective, this is a misconception. Or, if I look at these flowers and I'm having an unpleasant experience, together with the belief that those flowers are existing independent of us, we're going to naturally assume there must be some unattractive quality there that's causing my unpleasant experience. So we'll see them as inherently unattractive. Or, of course, if I'm having a neutral experience, we're going to believe that they have some inherent neutral qualities that's causing that experience. Once we've got to the third step, then the fourth step easily follows. Again, let's say we're looking at these flowers, we're having a pleasant experience, and we're believing that because of that, they're inherently attractive. Well, of course, I like pleasant experiences. I want pleasant experiences. Those flowers seem to be causing my pleasant experience, therefore I want those flowers. So that, of course, is attachment. Or if I'm having an unpleasant experience, I don't want unpleasant experiences. Those flowers seem to be causing my unpleasant experience. Get them out of here. So that's aversion. Or if I'm having a neutral experience, I'm just going to reinforce my belief that those flowers existing independent of me. So that's, of course, is ignorance. But often here, instead of using the word ignorance, you'll see the word confusion. But of course, this word confusion is not going, oh, are those flowers or not? It's confused about how they exist. So confusion here is we're confused about how they exist. We're believing that they exist independent of us. So this word confusion is just another word for ignorance. They mean the same thing. So when we get to this stage of either having attachment through pleasant experiences, aversion, unpleasant, or confusion or ignorance based on neutral experiences, then this is what is driving our behavior, these mental afflictions here. And from a Buddhist perspective, every action we do that is motivated by a mental affliction has a result, has a consequence. And the Buddhist assertion here is that every action we do motivated by mental afflictions leads to our experiences. And so we can have pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral experiences. And all of those experiences, collectively, in Buddhism, is referred to by the word dukkha, Sanskrit word. Which is often translated as suffering. But this leads to a lot of confusion, usually. Because here we're saying is our actions lead to our experiences, collectively called dukkha. So then often, with this translation, then what you often hear people say is, according to Buddhism, all our experiences are suffering. And then we hear that and we go, well, that doesn't sound right. You know, sometimes I'm having pleasant experiences. Are they suffering? I think the Buddha got it wrong. He didn't know what he was talking about. So we're not, because the word suffering for us normally means some sort of unpleasant, painful mental or physical experience. That's how we use the word suffering. And so when we hear someone say, according to Buddhism, all life is suffering, that's what we think they're saying. But actually, that's not what Buddhism is saying. Buddhism is saying all of our experiences are dukkha. This word dukkha is a much broader term than how we think of the word suffering normally. And we're going to look at that term a little bit later, what it really means. So that's the process of how from our ignorance that leads to our mental afflictions, driving our behaviour, leading to our current state of dukkha. So any questions about that process? Anything that's not clear? Yeah?
I'm not clear on a non-emotional feeling. I'm wondering how...
Non-emotional feeling.
Yeah, you're saying neutral experiences are not emotional.
No, what I was saying was that the word feeling doesn't mean emotion.
No.
No. So the word feeling, sometimes this is translated as sensation. So this mental factor is simply the mental factor that experiences things as either pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. From those experiences, a whole lot of emotions arise. Yeah? All sorts of things can arise. But we're talking about the initial experience. How do we experience things? Do we experience them as being pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral? Neutral just means neither pleasant nor unpleasant. So a lot of our experiences, you know, when we look at things, is a fairly neutral experience. So based on that initial experience, then of course we can have a whole lot of mental afflictions and emotions and so forth arising depending on the experience. But we're talking here about the initial experience.
Emotions are secondary to the initial feeling.
The what?
The emotions are secondary to
the initial in fact, in Buddhism, you won't see the word emotion. They never use the word emotion. So that's why it also can be very confusing. Because here, we're talking about what's called mental afflictions. But sometimes people translate this word, which is called klesha in Sanskrit, people sometimes translate this as disturbing emotions. But technically that's a bit misleading because some of these things are not really emotions. So I prefer to use the word mental afflictions, meaning they afflict the mind. Some of them may be more emotional and some less, but technically they're not all emotions as we normally know it. And generally in Buddhist psychology, you won't really see the word emotion. I mean, even things like love and compassion, you know, love we say is an emotion usually. In Buddhism, love is not an emotion. The way it's defined in Buddhism, it's an aspiration. And that aspiration can lead to some sort of emotional state. But from a Buddhist perspective, it's the underlying aspirations and so forth that are the key elements, not really what's being expressed. It's what's underneath that's important. So again, you won't generally see talk about emotions as such in Buddhism because it's the underlying aspirations and motivations that's the key element, not really how it's sort of being expressed, of course.
So what's the difference between the mental factor of discrimination and feeling?
the mental factor of discrimination is simply being able to distinguish one thing from another. So the mental factor of discrimination would, as part of the experience, would be able to say, oh, that's a glass. And then feeling is how we experience that object. I mean, there are many mental factors, of course, involved in every experience. And often in Buddhist psychology, we talk about 51 mental factors. But of course, you could make a list of hundreds of mental factors if you want. But often that's how it's described.
The confusion in four and the ignorance in two, are they completely synonymous, or is the confusion sort of like a grosser level of ignorance?
Well, with both ignorance and confusion, these words, you can talk about them in different levels, as we did before. The four, you know, these all can be termed ignorance. So, of course, these are not the same. These are sort of coarse to subtle, more or less. So similarly with the word confusion, you can use it. So it really depends on the context, how you use it. Here in this chart, this and this is synonymous.
Yeah. But that confusion wouldn't be that we think that things are stable. That's not that particular
confusion. No, not here. Not in this one. But in general, ignorance and confusion could be that. Mm-hmm. But particularly in this, we're here talking about just reinforcing this particular type of ignorance here. But of course, this could lead to that added level of confusion, but we're not really talking about that here. Okay. So this is how, from a Buddhist perspective, our fundamental ignorance of the nature of reality leads to our mental afflictions and our suffering, but suffering in terms of all of our experiences, not just our unpleasant experiences. And we're going to look at what this word dukkha means a little bit later as well. Now, there's one or two more things I want to add here before we move on. And that is, here, we talk, this level here, this level of feeling, is this stage two, is often very much emphasized in Buddhism. Because this is really where we really start to go wrong in terms of our experience. Because we react to our pleasant and unpleasant experiences in this way. So in a lot of Buddhist traditions, they put a lot of emphasis here in simply observing pleasant and unpleasant experiences without reacting. So you'll see a lot here in terms of mindfulness. And I think a lot of modern-day mindfulness movements are involved in this, is simply observing pleasant and unpleasant experiences, pleasant and unpleasant mental states, and not reacting to them as we normally do. But of course, if that's all we do, that can only get us so far, because this is based on ignorance, the reacting to this. So, yes, if we develop mindfulness, this can help to reduce how we react, but we won't be able to get rid of our reactions. We'll have to go here to... So this is a good first step. Develop mindfulness, reduce our reactions to our pleasant, unpleasant emotions, thoughts and experiences. So that's a good start. But then on top of that, we have to address this. And unfortunately, a lot of the modern day mindfulness movements strip away all of this other stuff because they say, oh, that's religious stuff. Oh, no, we don't want that. Or ethics. No, that's religious. Throw that out. So unfortunately, because they do that, then mindfulness becomes not very effective. It helps a little bit, but it doesn't really get us very far. So we need a framework for that. And so here we have a framework in terms of not only doing mindfulness, but then looking at our philosophical view and fixing that as well. And if we do those things together, then it's going to be much more effective in really overcoming our suffering. And then one more point here is we said that when we look out on the world, everything appears to exist independent of us. But Buddhism is saying that how things appear to us is not how they exist. But then you can ask the question, well, why, if they don't exist like that, why do they appear to exist like that to us? You know, if things really don't exist independent of us, why are they appearing to that in that way to us to begin with? To answer that, we have to go back here. Every time we have this ignorance operating, of course, it's reinforcing our habit of believing. So that's reinforcing. But what it also does is our ignorance has another side effect. And that is what's called the latency of ignorance. Sometimes that's translated as stain. In that every time we have this ignorance, it stains our mind. And what that stain does is that stain of ignorance in our mind means that every time we contact an object, it appears to exist independent of us. So this stain is like a bit like a filter. We're looking out on the world through the filter of ignorance. That's why things appear to us to exist in a mistaken dualistic way. So to really overcome all of this, we have to get rid of not only this ignorance and its habit, but we also have to get rid of these subtle stains in our mind. So this is what we are looking at in Vipassana practice, how to overcome this. Any questions on that chart then? Yeah.
Was there ever a time when we didn't have this stain of
ignorance? According to Buddhism, no.
Right.
Because, and this ties in a little bit with modern day physics, is everything has a cause. I mean, also one of the fundamental properties of physics is everything is created through causes and conditions. So that's why when they postulate the beginning of the universe, the Big Bang, they have to be very careful how they say that. I don't think they say it just popped into existence from nothing, because it would violate fundamental principles. Similarly in Buddhism, everything is created through causes and conditions. So you can't just say that ignorance just popped into existence at some point or the stain just popped into existence. It violates fundamental principles. So from a Buddhist perspective, it's always been there.
Didn't gradually occur with the kind of...
Well, again, it's causes and conditions, yeah. So
I suppose if you kind of... That link back to the latency, each time it just keeps getting worse.
Yeah, I mean, they're all self-feeding, but it's the process is there. I mean, it's a little bit like the physical world is, you know, that things look a bit different, but the fundamental physical basis has always been there. But how it manifests looks a bit different. So it's a similar idea here. Okay. One very last point, and then we'll move on to the next point, is here we said that when we, for example, look at these flowers, and let's say we have a pleasant experience, we get to the point of believing that the beauty is in the flowers. That's why I'm having a pleasant experience. But is there beauty to be found in the flowers? Can you find beauty in the flowers themselves, independent of our experience? If the beauty was there in the object, it would mean that everyone who saw those flowers would have to see them as beautiful because it's there, assuming they, you know, got proper visual perception. But they should see the beauty if it's there. But we know from our own experience, some people look and see that they're ugly. So, you know, the beauty is not there in the object. The beauty is created through our experience. So, you know, we sometimes hear this term, beauty is in the eye of the beholder. So intellectually, we may appreciate that, and that's fairly close to the Buddhist idea. But is that how we... So even if we intellectually accept beauty is in the eye of the beholder, is that how we relate to things like beautiful flowers instinctively? Do we? I think not. Because if we did, we would never have any craving or attachment to any pleasant experience because there's nothing there to grab. We're creating the beauty or the attractiveness. So, but the reality is, I think we all have craving and attachment for certain pleasant things, which means at that time, our instinctive way of perceiving that experience is not beauty in the eye of the beholder. It's inherently attractive. So that's what we need to fix. So again, even though intellectually we may appreciate some of these ideas as distortions, we still need to experientially fix that through Vipassana practice. We need to bring our intellectual understanding into direct experience through Vipassana practice. That's what it's all about. So let's have a look now at Vipassana practice. How do we overcome these distortions? And for that, we're going to look at this three vehicles chart that you've got. Sorry? I don't know. This is a fair one.
Sorry, we've run out of printed ones. If you wouldn't mind sharing, if you could sort of snuggle up and share them, I can provide one for them later on.
So we're going to look now at this three vehicles chart to get some context for Vipassana practice. So within the Buddhist spiritual path, we can talk about two goals. The first goal is called Nirvana. And Nirvana is liberation from suffering. It's to overcome all suffering and mental afflictions, to be liberated from that. And so if we achieve this goal of Nirvana, the person who's achieved that is referred to often in Sanskrit as an arhat. And an arhat often is translated into English as something like foe destroyer, meaning someone who's destroyed the enemy. So who or what is the enemy that the arhat has destroyed? The arhat has destroyed ignorance, all mental afflictions, and thereby all suffering. That's what they have eliminated. And so they have this state of nirvana, personal liberation from suffering and its causes. So the vehicle that can get us to that goal nowadays is commonly referred to as Theravada. And in those Buddhist traditions which are now labelled Theravada, which include like Sri Lankan Buddhism, Burmese, Thai, Cambodia, Laos and so forth, Southeast Asia, the goal of those Buddhist spiritual traditions is this personal liberation from suffering. Now, to achieve that goal, we have to develop the aspiration for that goal. And here is another classic case of how terminology creates confusion. Because often in English, the word that is used here, the aspiration we need to develop here, is this idea of renunciation. The idea of renouncing, giving up. So this is often presented as the entry point into the Buddhist spiritual path to develop this. But then people misunderstand and think, oh, to be a Buddhist then I have to give up everything and go and live in a cave for the rest of my life. This is completely not the case. And the reason is the term. Actually, this is a very poor translation. The original Sanskrit word is nisarana, or in Tibetan, ne chung. Both of those words literally means the aspiration to get out of. It means the aspiration to emerge from suffering towards the goal of liberation, nirvana. So literally this aspiration is an aspiration to be liberated from suffering. Unfortunately, it was many years ago translated as renunciation, and it stuck, and therefore that brings a lot of confusion because people feel like what I have to do is give up all my job and my money and everything, and I'm not allowed to enjoy any pleasant things. I'm not a good Buddhist if I do that, and then it's a big mess. So when you see this word renunciation in Buddhism, it simply means the aspiration to be liberated from suffering, the aspiration for nirvana, that's all. Now, in terms of the practices that we need to engage in to achieve the goal of nirvana, you'll see in your chart here, the normal way it's presented is what's called the Noble Eightfold Path, which are eight practices to achieve that goal. We can condense those eight practices into three core areas of practice, as you see in the chart, of ethics, concentration, and wisdom. So on an ethical foundation, we develop concentration, we develop single-pointed concentration, and then on that basis, we go into the wisdom practice. And this wisdom practice here, we're using the word vipassana. So often the wisdom practice is simply called vipassana practice. And so that's what we're looking at particularly today, is what is the wisdom practice of vipassana practice we need to engage in to achieve the goal of nirvana in this case. And we see next column there that the vipassana practice we need to engage in the Theravada traditions is what's called the three marks of existence. That we need to come to realize three things: impermanence, suffering, and no self. So if we look back at how we distort reality, the first way was that things are stable. So to overcome that, we need to realize impermanence, that things are changing moment by moment. To overcome the fact that experiences are in the nature of happiness, we need to come to realize this suffering, or what's actually the Sanskrit word is dukkha. And then to overcome the distortion of believing there's an autonomous self here, we come to realize there's no autonomous self. So these are the three insights we need to develop to overcome those three distortions. Again, maybe some of us intellectually accept all of those now. You know, I think we all intellectually accept this. Some of us may intellectually accept this, and some of us may even intellectually accept this now. But again, that's not enough. That's not going to get us liberation from suffering, because our behaviour is driven by instinctive habits. So to overcome this, we need not only to intellectually know this, we need to come to realise this experientially in meditation. We need to come to directly experience these things. So that's what vipassana practice is about, is bringing those intellectual understandings into experience through meditation, coming to realise these things. And here in the Theravada, when we come to directly realize that there's no autonomous self, we can achieve the goal of nirvana. When we say no self, of course, we're not saying no me, no person. There's no Buddhist tradition that says there's no me or no person. We're saying that there's no autonomous self, that we do not exist in this overinflated, autonomous way. That's what we need to realize. So this is vipassana. So when you go to Theravada traditions, and some of you may have done, for example, very popular these days is the Goenka Vipassana retreat. So maybe some of you have done this. The Goenka Vipassana retreat is coming from the Burmese tradition. So this fits within the Theravada tradition. And in that tradition, they are trying to realize these three things. In fact, that 10-day Vipassana Goenka retreat, effectively the one thing that's emphasized most, because it's a beginner retreat, is simply this. So if anyone who's done the retreat knows that often in his talks, Goenkaji goes, anicca, 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 which is a Pali word for impermanence. So he's trying to emphasize, we need to come to realize that things are changing moment by moment. But in the Theravada, we need to not just realize this, but realize suffering or dukkha, and that there's no autonomous self. We realize those, we can achieve the goal of nirvana. So that is vipassana practice in Theravada. So any Theravada tradition that talks about vipassana practice will talk about these three insights that we need to develop.
In that order?
Well, yes and no. Yes, that each one will naturally support the next. Do we need to fully realize this to begin to realize this? No, but there is a sort of, if we really put effort into this, this will naturally make it easier to realize this. if we realize this, we'll actually develop the aspiration to be free, which will support then this. So there is some basis, and in terms of subtlety, there is some degree as well. But you'll find that each one will help the other as well. Okay, so any questions about that? Again, this is just a brief introduction. In the next session, we're going to talk about these three insights in a little bit more detail. So it's just an overview now. Okay, so then we have also, and then we'll take a tea break after this, is we talk about the goal in Buddhism of enlightenment. And enlightenment and nirvana is not really the same thing. Enlightenment is a further step from nirvana, because nirvana is personal liberation from samsara, from suffering. Enlightenment, if we achieve the goal of enlightenment, we become what's called Buddha. And enlightenment, in that enlightened state, we are then much, because we're fully awakened now, we're much more effective in helping to liberate others. Because the vehicle that can get us to this goal is called Mahayana. And that includes the modern-day Buddhist traditions such as Chinese Buddhism, Zen, Korean, Tibetan and Mongolian and so forth. So in these traditions, which are referred to as Mahayana traditions or vehicle, the goal is enlightenment. Because here, the goal of the spiritual path is not just liberate ourselves from suffering, but to help liberate everyone else from suffering as well. So to achieve that goal, we need to develop the aspiration for that goal, which is called in Sanskrit, bodhicitta. Bodhi is Sanskrit for enlightenment and citta is Sanskrit for mind. So bodhicitta is literally the mind of enlightenment. It's the mind which aspires to enlightenment for the sake of others. If we develop this aspiration of bodhicitta, we are called bodhisattva. Again, bodhi means enlightenment. Sattva here means courage or strength. So a bodhisattva is someone who has the courage or strength to strive for enlightenment, for the welfare of others. In the Mahayana vehicle, if we want to achieve the goal of enlightenment, the core practices, as we see in your chart, is what's called the six perfections. Six practices, core areas of practice that we need to engage in. Things like generosity, ethics, patience, joyous effort, concentration, wisdom. So again, here we see the wisdom practice or the Vipassana practice. Now, here in the Mahayana, when we talk about Vipassana practice, then of course it includes all this three as a basis. But on top of that, in the Mahayana, we need to overcome this distortion. If we want to achieve enlightenment, we need to overcome this distortion that there's an independent me, independent objective world. So in Mahayana traditions, this is the key distortion we need to overcome. So the Vipassana practice, the main focus of Vipassana practice in Mahayana is to come to realize no independent me, no independent objective world. That realization in English is called the realization of emptiness. In Sanskrit, that is shunyata. So if you go to any Tibetan tradition, Mahayana tradition, like Korean, Zen, Chinese, Tibetan, Mongolian, and you look at what they do in Vipassana practice, insight practice, mainly they're talking about this. But of course, this is based on these three. So if we cultivate these three as a basis, that's going to be a good basis to develop this. So it's not like we're not developing these. In Mahayana, we need to develop those, but we need to go further and deeper to develop this if we want to achieve the goal of enlightenment. So that's so in the next session, we're going to briefly introduce these three practices, but then we're going to focus on this for the rest of the day, how to come to establish this intellectually and then how to practice it. So there's a third vehicle here, which I'm not going to really talk about. It's called Vajrayana or Tantra. And as you see, Vajrayana or Tantra is building on the Mahayana in terms of, in that level of practice, we have the same goal of enlightenment, we have to develop the same aspiration of bodhicitta, we have the same vipassana practice of emptiness. What's different, of course, in Tantra or Vajrayana practice is we are using a more subtle level of our mind to realize emptiness. And because of that, it's more powerful and we can accelerate the path. So Tantra or Vajrayana in Buddhism is a way to accelerate the path to enlightenment. So it's building on the Mahayana. It's not like, should I do Mahayana or Tantra? You know, which one will I choose? It's not like that. It's that Tantra or Vajrayana is building on Mahayana, which actually is building on Theravada. So these are like levels of practice. So we see in Tantra, we have the same Vipassana practice of emptiness as in the Mahayana. So that is very briefly the three vehicles, in particular the Vipassana practice. And these are the four things we're going to look at, emptiness in most detail. So we've got a few minutes before a break. Any questions about this chart? Yeah.
Yeah, so is the difference between the Theravada liberation of the self and emptiness within the Mahayana, the fact that it's only the self that's being liberated, not the dualistic understanding of world and self, so that that's the main drive of the Theravada, really, not the bigger picture of state and duality, which is what you put on.
Right. So this all comes down to really philosophical view. Like, the Buddha didn't teach Theravada and Mahayana. He wasn't a philosopher. He taught what people could help them. So he taught different things to different people. And from all those different teachings, what emerged was different philosophical systems based on those different teachings. So within Buddhism, you have at least four different philosophical systems. And they have a difference of opinion, particularly in terms of vipassana, what's needed to achieve nirvana and enlightenment. So generally, the philosophical systems that emerged that are the basis of the Theravada traditions now, those philosophical systems say, okay, to achieve nirvana, you need to realize this. Whereas the other philosophical systems, particularly the one we're going to be focusing on, called Majjhimika, they say that you need this even to achieve the goal of nirvana. So it's not so much the vehicles, it's more the philosophical systems that say what you need and what you don't need. So in the philosophical systems that are underpinning this, actually they would say, emptiness? No, 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 no. This is nihilistic view. This is nihilism. No, 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 no. So those philosophical systems would argue with the other Buddhist philosophical systems and say, you guys talking about emptiness, you're nihilists. You're saying nothing really exists. So there's a lot of internal dialogue there between the philosophical systems. So we're initially going to talk about the philosophical systems that say that's what needed to achieve nirvana. But then we're going to focus on the philosophical system called Majjhimika, which says that's good, but that's not even going to get you to nirvana. You'll need to realize this to achieve nirvana or enlightenment. So that's what we're going to focus on. Yeah.
Are you going to talk about later about the two different levels of obscurations, you know, afflictive and cognitive, and how they fit in with those?
Well, I can give you a brief answer now because that's really... Actually, I'll give you a brief answer now because I wasn't going to go into that because that's really like... we've only got so many hours today. But I'll give you a brief answer now. And you can look on your... To answer that question, if you go to your suffering and its causes chart, you'll see down the bottom these afflictive obscurations and cognitive obscurations. And they are the two things that are stopping us from achieving nirvana enlightenment. So what's called here the afflictive obscurations is what's stopping us from achieving nirvana, and the cognitive obscurations is what's stopping us achieving the goal of enlightenment. So if we go back here to this suffering and its causes chart, if we want to overcome suffering and achieve nirvana, overcome this and achieve nirvana, we need to get rid of this, ignorance. So this is the afflictive obscurations. You know, here it's listed as conception of inherent existence along with its seeds. So this is ignorance and the habit. So that's the afflictive obscurations. Sometimes bundled into the afflictive obscurations is also the mental afflictions. You'll see that as the afflictive obscurations, but the source is here. The cognitive obscurations, so if we want to achieve nirvana, we need to get rid of this, the afflictive obscurations. But then it says the cognitive obscurations is the latencies of conception of inherent existence and all factors of mistaken dualistic appearance that arise due to the force of those. So if we achieve nirvana, we get rid of this. We haven't got rid of this because this is hard to get rid of. So even in our heart, someone's achieved nirvana, things still appear to exist independent of them. But they know that's mistaken, so they never accept it. But if we want to go from nirvana to enlightenment, we need to get rid of these stains. So we need to get rid of these stains and the dualistic appearance that causes. So this is what's called these cognitive obscurations. These are very hard to get rid of. If we get rid of that, we can go from nirvana to enlightenment. So that's the afflictive obscurations and cognitive obscurations. But it's a big topic and we won't go into it. We got more than enough to do today.
I know that, you know, Tibetan Buddhism is based on these different philosophies,
mm-hmm.
Satrantika, Majjhimika, and so on.
Sure.
Is Theravada based on the Buddhist works?
Yeah. So, as I said, was that from the Buddha's various teachings, in ancient India, we have basically four philosophical schools evolving. In Sanskrit, they're called Vaibhashika, Sautrantika, Chittamatra, Majjhimika. So these evolved in ancient India. And it really was on the basis of the Vaibhashika, the first philosophical system, which was the one that really started to develop first in ancient India, that at that time Buddhism spread to these countries. So the basis of these is the Vaibhashika philosophical system. The Sautrantika, Chittamatra, Majjhimika really only started to gain hold in ancient India at a later date, and that's when Buddhism spread to China, Korea, Japan, Vietnam, and Tibet. So you'll find that the basis of those are particularly the Chittamatra, Majjhimika philosophical system. So it's a historical sort of thing, how they developed. But even within those traditions, of course, we have to distinguish between the philosophical basis of the tradition and the practitioner, what the practitioner actually realizing. So even though maybe in the Theravada tradition, they're talking about this philosophically, that's not to say that an individual practitioner may not realize this, even though it's not mentioned in their philosophical system. So we shouldn't assume that Theravada practitioners don't realize this. Maybe the philosophical text only talk about this, but that's not to say that the practitioner will realize this. And just because someone's in the Mahayana tradition doesn't mean they're realizing emptiness. They may not even be realizing any of this. You know, so we need to make a distinction between what the practitioner is actually realizing and the actual philosophical system that's the basis. Otherwise, we'd get some strange ideas. Yeah.
You mentioned briefly the kind of difference between saying an arhat would realise that appearances aren't real, but
yeah.
Somebody's realised emptiness. There is no.
Yeah. No. So
there's an actual difference in.
No, from the Majjhimika philosophical system that we're going to be looking at that talks about this, yeah. They would say, to achieve nirvana, you have to realize this. That's what they would say. But they would say, someone who's realized this, achieved nirvana, still have these stains in their mind. So even that person looks out and see, and it appears that that glass is existing independent of them.
Right.
But because they've realized emptiness, they know that that appearance is false. Right. So they never accept it.
Yeah.
It's a bit like lucid dreaming. If you're lucid in a dream, the dream will still appear to exist independent of you. But because you're lucid, you know that this is false. You never believe it. It's like that.
Yeah.
To get rid of that false appearance, we need to get rid of those stains.
Right.
Then someone who goes from here to here, a Buddha, doesn't see that as, it doesn't appear to exist independent. What that really means in experience is inconceivable for us because we've never had that experience. But it said an enlightened person doesn't have that mistaken appearance, that this appearances don't seem to be, things don't seem to exist independent of them. I mean, what that really means in experience, it'd be hard, it'd be inconceivable because we've never had that experience.
Is that what you just talked about, what Buddhism calls the two truths, as things existing in two different ways at the same time?
The,
and Arhat would realise that that's not a dependent object, but he still sees it.
Yeah, I mean, again, the two truths, and we're going to touch on that briefly this afternoon. Again, depending on the philosophical system you're talking about, the two truths are described quite differently. But here in this philosophical system, what we're going to focus on mainly today, the two truths, the ultimate truth is how things exist, is emptiness. And the conventional truth is the fact that, you know, things are interdependent. So that's sort of the two truths in this system. And we're going to touch on that briefly this afternoon. Yeah, last question, then we have a tea break.
Why is it called emptiness?
Ah, that's what we're going to talk about in the next session.
Okay.
Next session. Yeah. Yes. I mean, the brief answer is that actually it's a very literal translation of the original Sanskrit word. Shunyata, you know, actually shunya, coming from the Sanskrit, it means absence. And actually it's the basis of the number zero. You know, the number zero is, I think, an Indian philosopher or a mathematician developed the term, the word, the number zero,
yeah,
which is coming from the same term.
Yeah.
And it means hollow,
okay,
meaning no essence. There's no essence to it. But it doesn't mean it doesn't exist. But we're going to talk what that means after. So let's have a tea break and come back at 11:30.